From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Muslim leaders meeting Wednesday in Istanbul condemned President Donald Trump's December 6th declaration that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and called on the global community to recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Host Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said, in the view of the participants, Jerusalem is the capital of the state of Palestine. He invited other countries to join the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in recognizing the city as the occupied capital of the state of Palestine. Jordan's King Abdullah was among those condemning the U.S. decision. In Jordan, people gathered at a church outside the capital city of Amman for a candlelight vigil to oppose the U.S. decision. An OIC communique regarded the U.S. move as a decision that forfeits the role of the U.S. as a broker in reaching an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. It also referred to the decision as a crime and a violation of international law. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said President Trump's decision on how the U.S. views the city does not affect the city's ultimately final borders, which are dependent, she said, on negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians. 11 members of a militia group in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been sentenced to life in prison for the gang rapes of dozens of children and for murder. The fighters from the Army of Jesus group were accused of raping dozens of girls in the DRC's South Kivu province between 2013 and 2016. Human rights groups hailed the outcome but criticized the slow government response. This is VOA News. French President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday hosted the leaders of the 4,000-strong so-called G5 Sahel force aimed to tackle the growing jihadist threat across Africa's Sahel region. Mr. Macron said the war against terror in the Sahel zone must be won. He said attacks there occur on a daily basis. States are threatened and pledged to intensify efforts in partnership with the African Union and individual nations. France has thousands of troops in the region after intervening in Mali in 2013 to beat back an insurgency in the country's north. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have also pledged more than $150 million in support. British Prime Minister Theresa May's government Wednesday suffered a setback in its divorce negotiations with the European Union after Parliament approved an amendment to hand lawmakers more say over a final Brexit deal with Brussels. Parliament is currently debating the EU withdrawal bill, which will repeal a 1972 law that binds Britain to the European Union and copies existing law into domestic law. The vote comes ahead of a meeting in Brussels Thursday and Friday on the second phase of so-called Brexit, future bilateral trade relations. Britain is supposed to officially leave the European Union in March of 2019. The White House Wednesday signaled no negotiations with North Korea are possible until it improves its behavior. The comment came a day after U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the two countries could sit down for talks without precondition. A White House official told Reuters the Trump administration is united in insisting any negotiations with Pyongyang must wait until the regime fundamentally improves its behavior over nuclear and missile testing. Russia and China welcomed Tillerson's remarks. UN Undersecretary General Jeffrey Feltman Tuesday said his talks with senior North Korean officials reached agreement on the need to prevent a war, but did not reach any understanding on just how that might be resolved. But he said the door for a diplomatic solution remains ajar. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Wednesday warned the Security Council that Iran may be defying a UN call to halt its ballistic missile development. He said the UN is investigating whether Tehran is transferring ballistic missiles to Houthi rebels fighting the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Missiles have been launched toward Saudi Arabia in July and November. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is to hold a news conference Thursday to discuss the Iran nuclear deal and what she called Iran's destabilizing activities in the Middle East. And the U.S. Central Bank Wednesday raised a key interest rate slightly but left the level low enough to continue stimulating economic growth. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. World leaders announce new funding and greater urgency to fight terrorists in Africa's Sahel region.
French President Emmanuel Macron announced Saudi Arabia was contributing $100 million and the United Arab Emirates another $30 million to the G5 Sahel force.
That's correspondent Lisa Bryant in Paris. A human rights group pleads for Zimbabwe's new government to ensure free elections. The United Nations appeals for $1.7 billion in humanitarian assistance for South Sudan. And Cameroon closes its northern border with Nigeria following a series of Boko Haram attacks on ranchers.
We are suffering very bad about this situation of Boko Haram. That is the reason why all the traders cannot go to reach Nigeria now. We changed the direction, moving their activities to Douala or Yaounde.
Hamidou Bouba is the deputy mayor of the northern Cameroonian town of Bogo. Business and government negotiators discuss the act of deal-making to benefit African economies. And two officials of British International Academies will be here to discuss the progress of their partnership schools for Liberia. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. African and European leaders called for intensifying the fight against terrorism in the Sahel during a meeting Wednesday outside Paris. As VOA's Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital, the recently created G5 Sahel force received fresh funding pledges.
French President Emmanuel Macron announced Saudi Arabia was contributing $100 million and the United Arab Emirates another $30 million to the G5 Sahel force. The United States and European Union have already announced contributions of roughly $60 million each. Macron said France's 4,000-strong Barkhane operation in the Sahel will work with the G5 soldiers next year to combat jihadist groups in the region, such as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. He predicted victories against the groups early in the year. Wednesday's meeting west of Paris aimed to inject fresh support for the G5, launched last July to tackle rising terrorism across the vast expanse of Africa's Sahel region. Five African nations are contributing to the force, which is expected to grow to 5,000 troops by next March. But experts say it needs more soldiers, training, and funding, among other things, to tackle the spreading jihadi threat. Leaders also talked about other challenges.
En ce qui nous concerne le Sahel, nous sommes conscients.
Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, warned Wednesday that with their routing in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East, Islamic State group fighters could end up in the Sahel. Beyond French troops, other Western forces and UN peacekeepers are also present in the Sahel. A number have been killed in recent weeks. That includes four U.S. soldiers who were ambushed in October in a remote part of Niger, along with four Nigerian soldiers. UN and other African troops have also been targeted. This year also saw terrorist attacks in Mali and Burkina Faso. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Cameroon has closed its northern border with Nigeria following a series of attacks by Boko Haram militants on Cameroonian ranchers. The closure is meant to protect the ranchers' cattle, but as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports, it is also hurting the ranchers' business.
Hundreds of ranchers have brought their cattle and livestock to the Bogo market on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. According to Cameroon's government, this market is the supply point for most of the cattle sold across the border. But cattle rancher and seller Aminu Ngomna says he has not seen his Nigerian customers since September. He says business usually booms with the approach of the Christmas and New Year feasts, but that is not the case now. He says only customers from Marwa in northern Cameroon have been buying from the market, and the amount they pay per cattle is not up to what Nigerian buyers pay. Ngomna says the price per cow which ranges from $500 to $1,000, depending on size and weight, has fallen by half to as little as $250. Hamidou Bouba, first deputy mayor of Bogou, says the prices started dropping when Cameroon's government ordered the closure of parts of the border with Nigeria due to renewed Boko Haram atrocities. He says the number of attacks on farmers and cattle ranchers, which had fallen since January, increased in September with armed men crossing the border for supplies.
We are suffering very bad about this situation of Boko Haram. That is the reason why all the traders cannot go to reach Nigeria now. We changed the direction, moving their activities to Douala or Yaounde. That is the only solution. I think that we don't have another solution.
Bouba says the ranchers are being encouraged to transport their cattle some 70 kilometers from the affected zones to the nearest market, because even buyers from the hinterlands of Cameroon are refusing to travel to Bogou. Cattle ranchers and farmers comprise 80% of the population of the border areas. Cameroon reports that more than 100,000 have relocated due to the Boko Haram insurgency. Others live in abject poverty. Louis Paul Motaze, Cameroon's economy minister, says the government will build new markets in safer areas.
People here are suffering a lot, not only because of the war with Boko Haram, but because of poverty. This is why we would like to take into consideration another battle, and this battle is the battle for development.
The Boko Haram insurgency, which began in northeast Nigeria 8 years ago, has left at least 25,000 people dead and forced more than 2.6 million others to flee their homes, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bogou, Northern Cameroon.
The International Commission of Jurists is calling for Zimbabwe's new government to ensure free and fair elections next year. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the rights group is not the only one making the appeal.
Following a week-long visit to Zimbabwe, the International Commission of Jurists, led by its Secretary General Saman Zia Zarif, said soldiers who held President Emmerson Mnangagwa come to power last month must return to their barracks. The army has been policing Harare and other cities and has set up checkpoints along major roads. In an interview Wednesday with VOA, ICJ Director in Africa, Arnold Tsunga, said civic and opposition groups are worried the situation will compromise Zimbabwe's next elections, which are expected around the middle of next year.
That has been of concern, because at a time when the Secretary General was here, there were a number of pictures coming out on social media, as well as videos showing that the military readily resorted to the use of violence in order to drive their point home. There's also the question of the indeterminate number of people who are arbitrarily detained without effective judicial oversight. So the question of undermining due process rights, which is essentially the right to fair trial as a result of the involvement of the army in policing duties, that also was brought to the attention of the ICJ Secretary General. And he, in fact, made, as part of his exit press statement, a call that you don't need the army to be involved in policing duties.
Ibo Mandaza is the head of Southern African Political Economy Series, a regional NGO. He says the Zimbabwe government's over-reliance on the army confirmed it had gained power through a coup.
It's a coup. I said from the very beginning, didn't I? Mm-hmm. I've never changed my position. I find it very odd that anyone can celebrate a coup.
It has behaved in unconstitutional, clearly, which is not how an army should begin. It has become a fifth estate. You have a situation now where the military is above the executive, mm-hmm. above parliament. That's what a coup means. Hmm? So why should it be acceptable here? It's unacceptable.
What's going to happen now? That the military won't leave the streets until after elections.
That could lead to another disputed poll for Zimbabwe. Former President Robert Mugabe was accused of rigging elections for years, most notably the 2008 election, where he lost in the first round. On Tuesday, Zimbabwean opposition and civic leaders were in Washington and appealed to Congress for help in ensuring the 2018 elections are free and fair. The new government has asked for help in rebuilding Zimbabwe's moribund economy. The international community has said that will only happen if next year's elections are credible. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 14th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. The United Nations is asking for more than $1.7 billion to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance to 6 million people across South Sudan next year. A top UN official in South Sudan says the bulk of the money will be used to provide food assistance. The remainder would cover protection, health care, and education. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Alan Nodio, the UN humanitarian coordinator for South Sudan, teamed up with Hussein Marnot, South Sudan's humanitarian affairs minister, to launch the 2018 humanitarian response appeal in Juba. Nodio blames the ongoing conflict for the country's deteriorating humanitarian conditions.
There's indeed a growing need for humanitarian assistance, with displacement, food insecurity, malnutrition, violence, and economic decline, all combining to take a heavy toll on the health, the safety, and the livelihood of people in need in South Sudan.
Nodio says women and children in South Sudan bear the brunt of the conflict, which has caused acute malnutrition.
Approximately half of South Sudanese children under the age of 5 experience acute malnutrition. Half. And 2 out of 3 pregnant women or lactating women, mothers, also are just to be malnourished.
Nodio is urging the international community to donate generously in order to save lives of millions of South Sudanese amid the worsening humanitarian conditions across the country.
We are appealing for $1.72 billion to continue providing humanitarian assistance and protecting 6 million people in desperate need in South Sudan. The situation is dire.
Last year, the UN called for $1.6 billion to provide life-saving assistance this year. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says they received more than 70% of the 2017 funding appeal, which allowed humanitarian organizations to deliver various forms of assistance to 5 million people in South Sudan. Nodio says for aid workers to do their job, government and armed groups must allow unhindered access to people in need.
Humanitarian workers who sometimes risk their own life to provide assistance need to be fully protected and supported by all of us.
Nyot admits the situation for millions of South Sudanese is dire. He says recent violence in Jonglei State and parts of former Lakes State threatens to create even a bigger humanitarian crisis.
The figures mentioned by the humanitarian coordinator, these are figures that the government also confirmed. And I believed these figures with the new year will actually increase.
Nyot vowed that the Kiir administration will work closely with humanitarian aid agencies to ensure safe access to people in need across the country. 167 aid organizations aim to implement various projects under the 2018 Humanitarian Response Plan. Those include 95 national non-governmental organizations, 61 international NGOs, and 11 United Nations entities. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Almost 2 years ago, the Liberian government launched a partnership schools for Liberia, PSL, with British International Academies to improve student learning at selected schools. The program has come under criticism by some who feared it handicaps the poor because of its high costs. But two officials, Marcus Blair, director of British Partnership Schools in Liberia, and Seth Andrews, director of Policy and Partnerships, say the pilot project in Liberia has produced has produced amazing results in its first year, citing an interim study that critics say is not independent. Blair and Andrews say students at British partnership schools for Liberia learned twice as much as they would have learned in a year's time.
Using both self-assessment and independent assessment, the results have shown that just in the first year of the program, children at British schools have acquired almost over a year of learning that they would have had at the regular government schools that did not have the program. What that means is that children are learning two times more than their peers.
Has there been any independent assessment of this report that you're just giving me? Where did you get the figures? Seth, you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. So PSL program has 8 independent operators working in partnership with the ministry. The program as a whole had a randomized controlled trial by an independent third-party researcher, including Innovations in Poverty Action and the Center for Global Development. And that random control trial found 60% more gains for all of the students in the ministry program than the random control schools that weren't in the program. Bridge schools found 100% more gains, so basically double the learning in just 1 year of participating in Bridge PSL.
Marcus, the argument that some people have made is that this program is doing the opposite for what it claimed from the beginning to be doing. That is that the cost of your program makes it impossible for the very poor families to have access to this.
Well, the program costs $0 to the government. It costs $0 to parents. Mind you, James, the schools that we support with the government are public schools. These are, as you say in Liberia, they are government schools. So it costs $0 to parents to send their kids to the schools that they were already in. Additionally, students who attend the British public schools get free books. If you're a new student, you get a set of uniforms free. All you need to do is just show up at 7:30 in the morning and get a full day of learning.
How much did it cost the Liberian government? Because the argument here is that whatever money the Liberian government gave to this program, it could have put it towards public schools to improve them.
So the teachers at the PSL schools are government teachers. These are teachers who were in the school before the PSL took over. So they're not new teachers. Of course, some of them were trained and others were giving additional skills to be able to deliver high-quality lessons. So these are civil servants who the government would have paid their salaries anyway. So it's essentially cost neutral.
And in fact, so the government spent zero extra dollars on PSL programs, but it actually saved money because we helped the government to identify ghost teachers that were getting paid but weren't actually attending school or teaching. So the Ministry of Education was able to remove and save millions of dollars from identifying the ghost teachers and taking them off payroll who weren't there otherwise.
So what is the difference between the teachers who are teaching at the British partnership schools and the regular public school teachers in Liberia?
James, all our teachers, they are graduates of the teacher training schools that we have. These are certified teachers. These are government-approved teachers employed by the government and then giving additional training. So a typical teacher at a British public school, and I'll be specific, is more likely to have better training, better classroom management, is likely to be more accountable to the students, to be able to go to school on time, teach the lesson as required, and perform all those tasks that are required by the government of a public school teacher. So teachers are not necessarily thrown out, as you mentioned, but teachers are giving the capacity to improve themselves and to be able to deliver powerful lessons.
So Marcus, before I let you all go, what do you think is the future of this project? And is it true that you have signed a 5-year extension agreement with the government for this program?
The future is bright, James. And anybody who believes in education, who believes that our kids should compete with the child from the U.S., from any country that you will imagine, believes in this program. And we're happy that our parents are embracing the program, and we are quite happy that all stakeholders in Liberia have resolved to give this program the support it requires so that we can see what happens during the pilot phase. And then after that, the government can make a decision about its expansion. But we are very hopeful that, and we know, working with different partners, that PSL is a strong component of the overall educational strategy that the government will continue to implement in the coming years.
Marcus and Seth, it's so nice to talk with the both of you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you again for joining us.
James, thank you for all the work that you do to bring these stories to the world. And Bridge PSL and the program in Liberia is the most exciting thing I've seen in all of my 20 years in education.
And Marcus?
I just echo what Seth just said. There's an important revolution taking place in Liberia. We're happy for the support that we receive from our partners. We're happy for the confidence that the government has in us to be a trusted partner of the public-private partnership in education.
That was Marcus Blair, Director of Bridge Partnership Schools in Liberia, and Seth Andrews, Director of Policy and Partnerships for Bridge International Academies. They were speaking with me from Monrovia and Washington, D.C., respectively. Business and government negotiators from all over Africa met last week to discuss how deal makers need to hone their skills to benefit African economies. Maleku Desta is principal regional advisor to the UN Economic Commission for Africa. He tells Ricky Stryak that one of the biggest issues to tackle is Africa's natural resource management.
We spend a week talking about the key challenges that face African countries and African negotiators and how to address those challenges through training, through capacity building, through institutional support.
What are some of those problems that you think are the biggest issues right now?
Oh, that's a very good question. If you look at, for example, natural resource contract, and most of the contracts between governments, especially in natural resource-rich countries and foreign companies, they are negotiated very often with very weak capacity on the part of governments to identify, articulate, and defend the national interest. They often are happening in a very asymmetric kind of environment in terms of information, in terms of analysis, in terms of experience. So we are here to talk about, you know, what are the key issues that you need to pay attention to? Before you sign a particular contract, how do you make sure that the terms of that contract are favorable, are able to support employment in your country, beneficiation, i.e. value addition in the country, improve the chances of your country using its natural resource endowment to build its industrialization strategy, for example, to enhance its balance of trade, for example, to get out of that excessive dependence on the ever-fluctuating commodity prices at the international level by, you know, exporting value-added products rather than raw commodities, for example. Or you can go into the investment treaties world. Very often our countries sign bilateral investment treaties that they have not negotiated. Someone else on the other side of the table wants an agreement. They are cajoled into signing them without even thinking about their potential implications. Very often, they have been told, these countries have been told that the more investment treaties you sign, the more investment, foreign investment will flow. But in fact, over the past several decades, we have seen that there is no any rational relationship between the amount of investment treaties you sign and the amount of investment foreign investment you attract. So there are a number of things there.
That was Maleku Desta, Principal Regional Advisor to the UN Economic Commission for Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ghana's capital, Accra. Briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa news. The United Nations is asking for more than $1.7 billion to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance to 6 million people across South Sudan next year. And that is it for this Thursday, December 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a good day, Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.